also never serve, and I'm a sustaining member, and I give monthly on the internet. It's so easy to listen to WGXC Accra.
Tune in to all sorts of creative community programming Monday, September 14th on WGXC at 9 a.m. on the WGXC morning show after Democracy Now! We'll have a preview of village elections on Tuesday when voters go to the polls in Catskill, Athens, Ghent, Chatham, and Kinderhook. At 2 p.m., tune in the Vital Weekly show for all sorts of new music, including tracks from Natal Etch, Alan Curtis, Philip Gale, The Sheriffs of Nothingness, Blood Rhythms, and Credo and Doom. At 3 p.m., it's time for the Radio Art Hour with people like us, Gene Shepherd and Scanner. And then you can call in live to Tech Talk with hosts Ralph Benko and Bill Collier taking your technology questions at 7 p.m. Call in at 518-697-7400 to go live on Tech Talk on WGXC with your technology questions on the radio at 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Shannon Greer Photography in Brooklyn, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
There are village elections in Columbia and Greene County on Tuesday, September 15th, with the polls open from noon to 9 p.m. WGXC's Philip Grant has a roundup of the contested races.
Melanie Lekosubic is reporting for Columbia Greene Media. Village elections in New York will take place September 15th, 6 months later than originally planned as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. In the only contested race in Columbia County, voters in the village of Kinderhook are being asked to choose from four candidates vying to fill two vacancies on the village board. Michael Abrams, Robert Bausmeister, Mark Brown, and Doreen Weir. Abrams is running on the old Kinderhook party line. He has lived in the county since May 2015 and is the founder of Four Block, a nonprofit organization that helps military veterans transition back to civilian life. He is a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, having served 8 years active duty. He continues to serve in the reserves. Abrams attended Tamarack High School in Troy, received his bachelor's degree from SUNY Cortland, and an MBA from New York University. If elected, he hopes to bring new businesses to Kinderhook, wants to protect the integrity of the village water supply, and to lead efforts to, and I quote, reach out to developers, business owners, and potential visitors, end quote, to promote Kinderhook for potential new business. Incumbent trustee Robert Baumeister has lived in Kinderhook for 46 years. He is a retired Verizon area manager. Baumeister is a Vietnam veteran who served in the U.S. Navy. His name will appear on the Bell Party line on the ballot. Baumeister's priorities if reelected, including, and I quote, the new trail that will be opening up, the village will have to maintain it, end quote. He is also looking to complete plans for the new butterfly park. Other recreational sites are also on Baumeister's plans. He said, and I quote, the park on Rothamel Avenue, the tennis court has to be repaired again, and we have a lot of little rides for kids that have to be replaced, end quote. Candidate Mark Brown is running on the Shamrock Party line. He is a member of the Kinderhook Planning Board and chairman of the village's Comprehensive Plan Committee. Brown has been a resident of Kinderhook since 1996. He said, and I quote, I want to preserve the character of this rural historic community, support managed growth, and enable improvements to the services rendered, end quote. Brown is a past member of the Kinderhook Runners Club, a current member of the OK5K committee, race director for the Red Apple Run and Linden Walk Trail Run, and a member of the Northwest Columbia Trails. Candidate Doreen Weir has lived in Columbia County for 41 years. She's running on the Lyndon Wald party line. Weir is a graduate of Kevinney Memorial Academy and the State University of New York at Albany. Rebuilding infrastructure is at the top of her list of concerns if she is elected. Weir said, and I quote, "I believe that infrastructure is a top challenge for our village. If elected, I would assist in any way possible with aggressive and timely submission of the New York State Drinking Water Grant, along with written correspondence and personal interaction with our state senator," end quote. Maintaining a dialogue with constituents is key for Weir. The polls are open noon to 9 p.m. at Village Hall on Chatham Street, Tuesday, September 15th. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com.
Raymond Pignone is reporting for Columbia Green Media. In the village of Cooksackie, three candidates are competing to fill two vacancies on the village board. Thomas Noto Bartolo's and Rebecca O. Bermelia's names will appear on the Republican line. Caitlin E. Irwin's on the Democratic line. Noto Bartolo was added to the ballot soon after incumbent trustee Joseph Ellis died in July. A political newcomer, Noto Bartolo's goals, if elected, are to help get a handle on village taxes and to maintain the rural charm of the village. He supports growth that will enhance the village, not degrade it. Noto Bartolo wants to improve the connection between village government and the public by being more responsive to what is on the minds of residents. Noto Bartolo, 52, was a state corrections officer for 26 years before he retired in 2019. He graduated from Cooksackie Athens High School and is an active volunteer firefighter with Cooksackie Hose Company No. 3. Irwin says the village is experiencing a great deal of change and she is looking for more public participation in managing development. If elected, Irwin wants to balance growth with the qualities that make the village appealing. If elected, Irwin said she wants to bridge the gap between the new arrivals and those who have lived and worked there for their entire lives. Irwin, 36, is a wine steward and works part-time for the Cooksackie Athens Central School District. She is a graduate of SUNY Albany. Vermelia is a lifelong resident of Cooksackie. She is the former co-owner-operator of Vermelia's Downtown News and Lunch, True Value Hardware, V&S Variety, Vermelia Brothers Ice Cream Company, and a distributor of Leisure Time Water. She said, as a career business owner, she developed a strong appreciation of the role small businesses play in serving the needs of the community and employing local residents. Vermelia is retired from Greene County Emergency Services. Polls will be open 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Tuesday, September 15th at Village Hall at 119 Mansion Street.
Raymond Pignone is reporting for Columbia Green Media. In Athens, voters are being asked to fill two seats on the Athens Village Board. Three candidates are running. Incumbents Gail Lasher and Joshua Lipman running on the Democratic and Independent lines, and challenger Ricky Gabrielle on the Republican line. Gabrielle names high taxes and assisting the elderly as his main concerns. If elected, Gabrielle said he would revive economic incentives to bring additional businesses to Second Street. Gabrielle, a Little League coach and manager, is a former baseball umpire. He is an associate member of the Athens Fire Department. Lasher has served as a trustee for 10 years. She supports clean industry that will create and maintain jobs and opposes any commercial or industrial venture that could harm the environment along the village's shoreline. If reelected, Lasher said she would continue to work with her fellow trustees and community service organizations. Lipsman supports growth that can be held to the highest environmental, public health, and quality of life standards. He is also determined to protect the village waterfront. Lipsman is a strong supporter of the Joint Town-Village Comprehensive Plan to, and I quote, "address the economic, environmental, and infrastructure challenges we face," end quote. He lists as his proudest achievements in office a clean energy community designation and the Community Choice Aggregation Program. The successful candidates will each be elected to serve a 2-year term. On Tuesday, September 15th, the polls will open. from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. at the Rivertown Senior Center. Information is at 518-719-3550.
Amelia Teasdale reports for the Columbia paper that in Chatham, Philmont, and the Valencia villages, there are uncontested elections on September 15th. Melanie Spock and first-time candidate Jody Russell are running for two open seats in Chatham, and Philmont and Valencia incumbent board members are running unopposed for the open seats. Voting is noon to 9 p.m. at the Philmont Village Hall, 124 Main Street, in Valencia at the Martin H. Glynn Municipal Building, 3211 Church Street, and in Chatham at the Morris Memorial, 77 Main Street. Masks are required in Chatham as the County Board of Elections is in charge of the voting there. Read more about these elections in the Columbia paper. The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a slight chance of showers, a 20% chance on Sunday after 2 p.m., some fog in the morning. Otherwise, it'll be partly sunny with a high near 72 and a low around 57 Sunday night with a 30% chance of rain before 1 a.m. Monday should be mostly sunny with a high of 69 and a low around 41, and Tuesday should be sunny with a high of 66 and a low around 45. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, radio for open ears.
Call the WGXC feedback line anytime, 518-291-9492. If you have something to say about something you heard on WGXC, give us a call right at audio letter to the editor. Call in at 518-291-9492. Leave a 3-minute message and we'll play it back on All Together Now. That's 518-291-9492. To leave an audio letter to the editor at 518-291-9492. WGXC at 518-291-9492.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Judd Malton of Hillsdale, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Now let's begin.
You have 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Don't worry if you can't follow everything that is said. Now repeat.
Thank you. Welcome, radio listeners. You're listening to Bound by Books Youth Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, and Hudson. Listener-supported radio for open ears. I'm Emily. I'm the director of the Hudson Area Library, and I, together with my youth co-hosts, Amelia, Mashuda, Fahim, Lena, AJ, and Fatia, we talk about books every week on WGXC. And due to the Labor Day holiday, we were not able to record together this week, but Mashuda and Fatia, who had not been able to join us for a couple weeks, sent some recordings, and so we're going to share those with you today, along with some music and poems that we like. So we hope you enjoy, and have a good week.
Eight balloons. Eight balloons. No one was buying. All broke loose one afternoon. Eight balloons with strings of flying, free to do what they wanted to. One flew up to touch the sun. One thought the highway might be fun. One took a nap in a cactus pile. One stayed to play with a careless child. One tried to taste some bacon frying. One fell in love with a porcupine. Ooh, one looked close in a crocodile's mouth. One sat around till his air went out. Eight balloons, no one was buying. They broke loose and away they flew, free to float and free to fly and free to where they wanted to.
Hi, my name is Fatia and I'm 6 years old and an author from Hudson. Today we're going to read a book that is Cookie and Barkley Going to School. Cookie and Barkley were going to school. At number one day, they were going to school today. The Barkley was very angry. The cookie was very sad. The cookie was very happy. And then they fighted and they did this and then got angry. Why was that cookie happy? Cookie likes school so much. And the Barkley hates school so much. And then they made a shadow. And the cookie said, yes. The Barkley said, no. They got best friends forever again. Paint wall. They're going to get bit by the red skeleton. Red hot. And then they fight punched it. They got angry so much. Cookie and Barkley got made. Tomato the friend was very tiny. He was a little tiny people. And then the Barkley and the tomato talks to the Barkley. Cookie and the Barkley's opposite of each other. And then the cookie said, yes. And the Barkley said, no. Paint wall. And then the fire came. It was a drawing the kids made. Barkley and Cookie made the drawing. They had so much fun together. The Barkley yelled, where is room 5? The said then. They go to room 5 and then room 5 said, ah! The teacher said, don't disturb my class. And then Abby 1 was there. Cookie and Box was found room 5. They all have fun together. cookie was very angry at the broccoli. The broccoli was very angry at the cookie. But still, they were friends. The cookie was very happy. The broccoli was very angry. They still continue the journey. And they have so much fun together. The end. Was that good?
Hello, my name is Mishira, and I'm 18 years old, and I'm from Hudson. I hope you're all doing good and staying healthy and well. My book is Sanctuary by Paola Mendoza and Abby Scher. It's 2032, and in this near future America, all citizens are chipped and everyone is tracked, from buses to grocery stores. It's almost impossible to survive as an undocumented immigrant. And that's exactly what 16-year-old Vali is doing. She and her family have carved out of a stable, happy life in small-town Vermont. But when Vali's mother, counterfeit Chip, starts malfunctioning and the deportation forces raid their town and they're forced to flee. Now on the run, Vali and her family are desperately trying to make it to her Tia Luna's California, a sanctuary state that is currently being walled off from the rest of the country. But when Vali's mother is detained, before their journey even really begins, Vali must carry on with her younger brother across the country to make it to safety before it's too late. Gripping and Argent co-authors Paola Mendoza and Abby sure have crafted a narrative that is as haunting as it's hopeful and envisioning a future where everyone can find sanctuary. This is really compelling, visually compelling book so far, and I'm really enjoying reading it. So you guys should check it out. The book is Sanctuary, Paola Mendoza and Abby Scher. I'm really excited for the actual published version, and I'm going to read that version again. Yep, thank you.
Listen to the mustn'ts, child. Listen to the don'ts. Listen to the shouldn'ts, the impossibles, the won'ts. Listen to the never-haves. Then listen close to me. Anything can happen, child. Anything can be.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mishuda. I'm 18 years old, and I'm from Hudson. I've been reading the book called Feed by Matthew Tobin Anderson. It's a novel, a dystopian novel, a science fiction, and mixed with young adult fiction. Feed is a young adult dystopian novel of the cyberpunk subgenre written by M.T. Anderson. The novel focuses on issues such as corporate power, consumerism, information technology, data mining, and environmental decay, with sometimes sardonic, sometimes somber tone. Feed is placed in future tense, which has an explanation and importance of the danger of technology and internet. It has a lot of similarities and explanation of what's going now, this our times, 2020. And you know, it teaches us how we humans are so relied on technology that we lack of critical thinking. We can't solve problems by ourselves. We are always visiting or searching on Google or any other internet web page to get answers. In Feed, it talks about normal teenagers. They just, it's an everyday thing for them to visit Moon. And when they don't, you know, visit Moon when they don't have school, it's an everyday thing. And they visit there, they hang out together with their friends, and they come back. And when they come back to this earth, they're partying all the time besides studying. And it shows that how advanced technology is, that those normal teenagers who are, you know, how teenagers are supposed to be mature, those normal immature teenagers can just use technology and visit any planet they want. But still, there is disease that's damaging and hurting and killing all those people. This simple disease is called whipping sores. You know, even when the technology is so advanced, then why are this simple small disease like whipping sore harming those people? The answer is because the technology doesn't have answer. They can't just go and search the solution on Google, say, what's the side effect of whipping sore, or how can I prevent whipping sore? And they can't just rely on internet, because the internet doesn't know. You know, technology is not better than a human brain, because a human brain created those technologies. So since they don't have any knowledge to use it, they don't have any critical thinking and problem-solving skill, they can't solve this simple thing. And in this feed, it shows that it's a world full of teenagers. And you know how they're using slang, they're immature. That's why they can't solve this simple problem. But the only teenager that's smart is Violet. Violet is a nerd, and she knows a lot of the answers because she's an outcast. She doesn't hang out with the other teenagers that consider normal in their times, like acting dumb, partying, not doing their homework, not doing their schoolwork, just partying and going to Moon and hanging out and saying silly stuff. You know, always, you know, they can't even spell. Those teenagers can't even spell or read, and they need translation for normal English. You know, they can't do anything without internet. But Violet herself, she can read books because she's an outcast. She doesn't hang out with them. So this book does a really good job of danger of relying on internet too much. And it also scares me a little bit because, you know, nowadays people are putting credit card chip on their hand, under their hand, like inside their hand skin, and you know, to prevent theft, credit card theft. But still, it's scary how, you know, you could use technology inside you. Yeah, so this book is really good, and if you guys want, you can check it out. The book is called Feed by M.T. Anderson or Matthew Tower Anderson. Thank you.
If the world was crazy, you know what I'd eat? Big slice of soup, whole quarter meat, lemonade sandwich. Then I might try some roasted ice cream or bicycle pie. A nice notebook salad or some underwear roast. An omelette of hats and some crispy cardboard toast. A thick malted milk made from pencils and daisies. And that's what I'd eat if the world was crazy. If the world was crazy, you know what I'd wear? a chocolate suit and a tie of eclair, some marshmallow earmuffs, some licorice shoes, and I'd read a paper of peppermint news. I'd call the boys Susie, I'd call the girls Harry. I'd talk through my ears, and I always would carry a paper umbrella for when it grew hazy to keep in the rain. If the world was crazy. If the world was crazy, you know what I'd do? I'd walk on the ocean and swim in my shoe. I'd fly through the ground and I'd skip down the air. I'd run down the bathtub and bathe on the stair. When I'd meet somebody, I'd say, goodbye, Joe. And when I was leaving, then I'd say, hello. And the greatest of men would be silly and lazy. So I would be king if the world was crazy.
Hi, I'm Fatina, and I'm 6 years old, and I'm from Hudson. Hudson! And today I'm reading about Q and U hanging up together. They are having so much fun. They hang up together as well. Best friends forever. They quack together and squeal together at the square, squeeze together at the bus. They find the coin together. They look at the queen together. They study together. They be sad when it's quiz. They earthquake together. They don't leave their self behind. They're always together. Because they're best friends. And thanks for listening to what I was reading to this book, Q and U. I hope you read it too. Can you please read it? You have to find it at the Chromebook, readingkidsaz.com. You go there and find this book, Q and U, Best Friends by Karen Mara Markler. Thank you. And bye.
What is the census? As mandated by the U.S. Constitution, the census is a once every decade count of everyone living in the country. When we know how many people live in our community, organizations, and businesses are better equipped to evaluate the services and programs needed, such as clinics, schools, and roads. The census also determines how seats in Congress are distributed among the 50 states. In March of 2020, the U.S. Census Bureau sent every household an invitation to complete a simple questionnaire about who lives at your address on April 1st. You can respond online, by phone, or by mail, and federal law keeps those responses safe and secure. Shape your future. Visit 2020census.gov.
Zebra question. I asked the zebra, are you black with white stripes or white with black stripes? And the zebra asked me, are you good with bad habits or are you bad with good habits? Are you noisy with quiet times or are you quiet with noisy times? Are you happy with some sad days or are you sad with some happy days? Are you neat with some sloppy ways or are you sloppy with some neat ways? And on and on and on and on and on and on he went. I'll never ask a zebra about stripes again.
Thanks everyone for listening. We hope you have a good week with lots of quality reading time. Happy reading.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Good day, all. Today we're going to be hearing from Miriam Axel Lute, editor of Shelter Force magazine and a regular writer and analyst of housing justice and community development issues for over two decades. We'll be hearing Miriam, who spoke during a webinar recorded on July 1st, 2020, in partnership with the nonprofit Quarterly Organization. The topic of the webinar was housing justice amid COVID-19.
My name is Miriam Axel Lute. I'm the editor of Shelter Force magazine. We're a national publication, as Steve mentioned, that covers affordable housing, community development, housing justice, healthy neighborhoods. And we write for people who are working in those areas or whose work intersects with those topics in some way, even if they don't see themselves as housers first and foremost. But our core readers are often community-based nonprofit leaders. You know, everybody's worried right now about what's going to happen when eviction moratoriums lift. Many places put various eviction moratoriums of various strengths in place to try to make sure people could shelter in place. But many of those have just lifted, are starting to lift, are about to lift. And the people who lost their jobs, most of them have not gone back to work. Unemployment supplements are about to wind down. Those who are back at work did not get other, you know, did not necessarily get back pay. So there is this massive wave of evictions that is pending unless something more is done. And it should be pretty obvious what a catastrophe that would be. Now, there's a range of responses that we could make to that. The ones, there's a lot of people who are working on standing up court defenses and mitigation programs, negotiation and other things. But the thing that would actually prevent that wave of evictions is either, it falls into two broad camps, sort of rent relief or rent cancellation. And many of you have heard the term cancel rent, about the cancel rent movement. Which is one of those. So rent relief, and there's a large, in the HEROES Act contained and the bill that Elizabeth Warren just put out, both contain pieces of this, would be targeted payments to those who need help to pay their rent. Rent cancellation would say the rent does not need to be paid, and then figure out how to address relief to owners as needed through mortgage cancellation or other means. And there's some tension between these. They both have the same goals. There are some pros and cons to both approaches. Some of the pros to rent cancellation is that it would include everybody who needs it, including the most vulnerable renters. Rent would not need to be paid, and it would be instant. Whereas if you have to be eligible for government help, you're going to start losing people who are undocumented workers, people who are in the informal economy, people who were already out of work when the pandemic hit, and so on, and people who have difficulty pulling together the documentation. And we're already hearing in New York City, for example, that landlords are on the move trying to get personal financial information out of their tenants to see who they're allowed to evict now that there's a measurement about whether you were affected by COVID or not. So rent cancellation is unequivocal housing stability for renters. And then the paperwork and the targeting and the processing and the figuring out how to get relief out would fall on the owners. And it may actually be better for them as compared to evicting a tenant and losing back rent. Now, there are some cancel rent proponents who are, in fact, organizing with small landlords under a broad no new debt mantra where they're calling for mortgage cancellation and rent cancellation at the same time with an understanding that their interests are connected. You know, there are cons as well or dangers. So it's obviously if you cancel rent for everybody, including those who are currently able to pay, you're bringing a larger disruption to the housing system. There's possible added disruption to small landlords, nonprofit housing providers. Rent doesn't just pay for mortgages and profit. It covers a wide range of costs that keep housing operating, taxes, insurance, utilities, repairs. So there's a fear that if you do that, particularly without sufficient support to housing providers, it would increase the ability of private equity to come in and scoop up more small rental properties, which further destabilizes the housing system in the long run. We saw a bunch of that in the 2008 financial crisis, and nobody wants that to happen again. And of course, reimbursing owners for all rent payments would be extremely costly, as opposed to targeting the resources more. You know, Urban Institute recently estimated that when unemployment assistance expires, it's going to take $15.5 billion a month to alleviate cost burden for renters who were cost burdened before the pandemic and for renters who lost their jobs as a result of it. And that's even just with that targeting, though it's a fairly broad targeting. And I think some of the key questions are, can we find a way to address the questions and the concerns that are raised by both of these approaches? Can we make a rent relief program that reaches everyone in need, or figure out another way to get to all of those most vulnerable renters? Can we cancel rent in a more targeted way, or a way that really protects the small landlords and housing providers that we don't want to lose? In either case, are we prepared to capture the rental properties that are going to be sold or whose owners are going to walk away, which is going to happen under either scenario, and bring them into some kind of permanently affordable housing? And I think an important question is, can we find a way to come together across these philosophies and make sure that something, and to Amina's note, something big enough does happen?
Great. Thanks, Miriam. That's really helpful. I thought I'd just ask about one wrinkle on this. So I've seen ideas of extending mortgages. So in other words, if the payments for the landlord were suspended for 6 months, then their mortgage will be extended on the back end for those six months. Is that part of the conversation still?
Absolutely. That's the approach to forbearance that's going to work, right? I mean, having a mortgage forbearance for a couple of months and then having it all come due is very similar to having an eviction moratorium and then having it lift. That doesn't do anything but have that temporary pressure on the wound. We do need to have these transferred into what will be a modification. It has to be a modification to add those payments on the end of the mortgage to really have that help be sustainable.
Next, Steve Dubb, senior editor at NPQ and the moderator for the webinar, speaks with Andromeka Morris, executive director for Housing NOLA, a 10-year partnership between community leaders and dozens of public, private, and nonprofit groups implementing a strategic plan designed to reduce housing insecurity in New Orleans. Andromeka continues the conversation on what can possibly happen when the rent moratoriums end and the mortgage forbearance programs end.
Andromeka, anything you want to say about what do you see as the appropriate policy response in this period?
So I agree with Miriam that we have to first and foremost decide that we're going to do something about this. We haven't made that decision yet. And that's a part of the problem. And again, this is pre-COVID. This is the deep structural bias around affordable housing because no one talks about this. And those of us who do the work, certainly we've got allies on this issue, but I'm talking about as a movement, there is no real commitment to this in the hearts and minds of our policymakers and our elected officials. And that decision that's got to be the first decision, that we decide to do this, and that will guide how this works. We're concerned about making sure that people who are using landlord property or rental property as income are also not left out in the cold, but we also want to make sure that there are not these unreasonable barriers, because right now health is connected to housing. As we see surges in the COVID pandemic, if we do not have another shelter at home order, which seems unlikely throughout the lifetime, it may not happen in the next few months. All estimates tell us is that before a vaccine, we will probably have another wave that will require everyone to shelter at home. We need to make sure that everyone actually has a home that they can do that in. And that means be you formerly incarcerated, be you currently incarcerated, homeless, housing insecure, doubled up with family, or, you know, working a job that doesn't allow you to make ends meet. All of those folks need to have assurances that they will actually be able to be safe. And that's got to be key to this commitment. And as we come out of this, then we've got to start talking about the long-term solutions so that this never happens again.
And that concludes a portion of a webinar on housing justice amid COVID-19. And this is Michelle Masurjian for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra, and we are now joined on the phone by, I'm probably going to mispronounce her name, Raina Higashtani. Excuse me, I thought I was going to get it right. Are you there, Raina? Oh, we can't hear you. Let's see. We'll have to do it this way. Can we hear you now?
Yes.
All
can
right.
You hear me?
I can hear you now, yes.
Okay, great. Hi.
Hello. How is things? You're at the catwalk you're the artist in residence currently at the catwalk in Catskill. So you're overlooking the Hudson River right now?
Yes. It's beautiful, amazing view over the Hudson River, toward the Hudson River.
Although it was drizzling a little here in Accra. Is it raining over there too today?
A little bit, I think. But yeah, it's a little cloudy today. But still, I mean, you know, cloudy doesn't really matter. It's just still beautiful scenery here.
Is this your first time in the Hudson Valley?
Actually, I've been not exactly in this area, but I have a friend in Catskill. So, I visited his place a couple of times. Yes.
And is this your first time? You do films, but now you're starting to work on a podcast. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I'm a filmmaker, currently based in New York, and I just came back actually from Los Angeles, where I lived for 5 years until June. And I'm also originally from Japan, and I have been living in the States for 20 years. So I decided to do the podcast this time. So I love to talk about it.
So it seems to me like, people doing films, doing sound isn't too radical a departure, since films mostly have sound and are kind of edited in the same sort of way that sound is edited. Have you found it a large departure, or working without images, how have you found it?
I don't think it's a large departure because it's still the storytelling. So I think the basis is same in terms of that. And also I worked in the documentary for quite a long time, about more than 10 years. So I'm kind of familiar with, dealing with the audio and everything. And also in the fiction film, we do a lot of sound effects and working with composers and sound mixers. So I think there are many overlapping parts. But also I discover a lot about the difference, because it's basically you need to rely on sound, of course, to tell the story. So you need to kind of find a way to really engage the audience through just by audio storytelling. And I started to notice a lot about how I speak. And also how I talk, and and how much speed I should be talking, and if it's too slow or too fast, and depending on the contents, you might want to slow down, and those kind of technical things that I'm kind of learning as I go. But also I found a big advantage of doing the audio storytelling is that it gives a less pressure to the people I interview. It looks like it gives more flexibility or accessibility for the interviewees to feel like they are more relaxed in that audio storytelling rather than showing their face and care about how they look. So I found it, it's actually very good storytelling tool, especially when I want to talk to people who are like ordinary common people.
And that's what you're doing is largely talking to people with this podcast, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm interviewing local people in this area.
And you're interviewing mostly Asian immigrants? Is that the thrust of the podcast?
Yes, yes. So if you allow me to talk about a little bit about the background, is that basically at the beginning of the pandemic, I experienced a lot of frustration and anger over how Asians are treated. And also that because of the shutdown of any physical filming productions, I find myself plenty of time to think about what kind of stories that really matters to me. And I thought about, I like to talk about Asian American history and experience, and with the limited access to the equipment, I thought developing an audio storytelling series would be a best choice for me right now. So that's the background.
And I guess the Asian Americans is a large topic. What specific communities have you talked to in the Hudson Valley?
So since I'm originally from Japan, I've been talking to Japanese immigrants and the Japanese Americans, but I also had a chance to talk to some of the residents in this Catwalk Institute. So some of them are Korean American or have a person with Chinese ancestry. So those people I have a chance to talk to more about the research to develop the idea.
And what sort of stories are they telling you? What is life like for Asian immigrants in the Hudson Valley?
It's kind of fascinating. I really didn't think that I would meet such so many interesting people. And one of the women I talked to, she's a Japanese immigrant. She's 88 years old, and she moved to the United States in 1952. And she's actually a Hiroshima survivor. So she lost her family, entire family, to atomic bomb when she was 13. And after she moved to United States through some temporary relationship, and then she married to a former American soldier, and she... Yeah, she's living in almost 70 years in this region. So,
wow, that's going through Hiroshima and then marrying an American soldier seems, I don't know what the right word for is, but it seems like something.
Yes. And you know, she's not really an exception. And I was really taken back by the fact that Hiroshima survivor is even, you know, marrying to an American soldier and moved to the United States and, you know, find this place as their home. But there are many other people who have a kind of similar story and have a different experiences, and you know, sometimes they have a lot of prejudice against them, and so it's really fascinating to hear their stories and learn about, and it kind of gives me a good access in terms of, like, I can take advantage of doing the podcast and ask really deep questions that people might hesitate to ask, you know, when you just meet. So I'm learning a lot from their experience and made me think about how I should form my identity as well.
And are you finding you are, you know, a lot of people that do audio or leave it up to listeners or viewers, I mean listeners, to come up with